And they were really kind of the intellectual engine that ran this. What are you laughing at me for?
No, go ahead.
A dude and a lady. What?
I mean,
that's
it's
what
just,
they are.
Everyone, this is
it's
the,
my level of research.
I was going to say this is the.
Did
level...
I get their genders correct? Yes or no?
Yes, but
thank
this
you.
Is the level of research you
please
can
point
expect.
Out. Please point out where I've made an error anywhere in my reasoning.
It's just a little bit lack of detail. Wow, well, that's all right. Everyone,
I'm just
He's
think of it
trying.
As an impressionist painting.
He's trying.
Thank you.
Good job.
Ish.
Hi, and welcome to Gen Extemporaneous. This is a podcast where I come up with an idea, I do some research, I grab a bottle of wine, I bring everything to Mark, and he pontificates. After a couple of weeks palate cleanser, while I did more reading and research, we are once again back into the true crime arc, and today we are discussing true crime amateur sleuths. We are going to be discussing the evolution of sleuthing, how sleuthing can help, how it can harm, and overarching it all is what some online scholars have identified as a late modern backlash against experts. We're going to be asking the question, do they sleuth because they do not trust the prevailing authority, and how does solipsism fit into everything? Mark and I are not internet sleuths, but we can't rule out that at some point they will figure out exactly what we did in the woods as teens and feel very disturbed. We're kind of sorry about that, but we're Gen X. We got our sensitivity chips late in life, and we're still learning how to use them. Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso. Did you just accuse me of a crime?
No, I just said, you know how that is. When people talk to Gen X, we always are like, do you know what we did in the woods? Or did, like, the woods always come into it?
Yeah.
Because didn't you go into the woods?
I went into the woods, and what I did is none of your business.
I was in the woods all the damn time.
I bet you are.
I know what you were doing in the woods.
Filthy little monkey.
I know what you were doing in the woods.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so Mark, we're back on true crime and the internet sleuths. You actually had a lot of homework in this episode.
It sucked.
Give me a hot take on internet sleuths. What do you think of internet
sleuths?
They are
crazy. No, so it really depends, right? It depends on how all in they go and how measured they are. Mm-hmm. But in general, I find them to be a little bit true crime porn fans, right? They're really into all the details and the horrific nature of it. And then they try to solve the crime, which they're really, in general, not always, but in general, not that well equipped to do. Mm-hmm. And
in spite of the power of the internet.
Yes. I mean, the internet does have power, but you can't, if you don't have direct access to the crime scene in the original crime docs and you're solving the crime by watching YouTube videos. I mean, if it's a real obvious crime, yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. But in general, the police are probably looking at the same thing. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't occasionally flashes of crowdsourced brilliance, but unfortunately, their confidence in their theory is not in proportion to their investigative skills. Let's
correct.
Just say that.
Correct. Right?
They think that if when they stumble on something that they think they have some evidence for, they are convinced of their own genius, and they don't look for ways to break their theory. They look for ways to reinforce their theory.
Correct. Okay, and we'll get into that more in depth as we go on. But
I'm sorry, did my hot take have too much deep thought and reasoning?
It really did. It did, because now what else do we have to
talk
about?
I know, we're done.
So in this episode, Mark, you had a lot. You had actually a fair bit of homework to do.
Yeah,
I certainly
awful.
Did a lot. So I'm just going to go through our sources. We'll have everything called out in the episode notes. Our sources, and they were interesting sources.
Yeah, for the most part.
Okay.
At least the ones I was exposed to.
Right. Okay. So, Mark, you watched something that I can't watch because
right.
I can't watch it.
Yeah,
but
I watched Don't Fuck With Cats.
The subtitle of which is Hunting an Internet Killer. It was released in 2019. It is a three-part docuseries about an online manhunt. It was written and directed by Mark Lewis and released on Netflix in 2019, as I said. The series chronicles events following a crowdsourced amateur investigation into a series of animal cruelty acts committed by a Canadian pornographic actor, Luca Magnotta, which all these acts of cruelty to animals culminated in his murder of a Chinese international student, Jun Lin. And so that is the...
That was a tough one to watch.
Okay.
I can tell you that.
I am sure. And we're gonna so our conversation is going to be kind of peppered with all of these references. Sources and references. Yes. Okay. You also watched Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, which was released in 2021. It is a four-part American docuseries directed by Joel Berlinger that chronicles the mysterious disappearance and death of Elisa Lam, a Canadian woman who was traveling in California on her own.
Well, look, if you're looking to get taken out by a serial killer, California is a good place to go.
It really is. But what we will find out in this documentary as well is a lot about online sleuths.
Okay. We definitely will.
I watched I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is an American true crime documentary television series directed by Liz Garbus, Elizabeth Wolfe, Miles Kane, and Josh Khoury, revolving around Michelle McNamara as she writes a book about and investigates the Golden State Killer.
And she is also famous for being the late wife of Patton Oswalt.
That's correct. In this world, she is the star.
Oh, she is the star, no doubt.
True Crime Addict is something else I read. This was a book. Its subtitle is How I Lost Myself in the Mysterious Disappearance of Maura Murray, which was released in 2016. So this is, as the title suggests, the book about the strange disappearance of Maura Murray, who was a University of Mass at Amherst student who went missing after wrecking her car in rural New Hampshire.
Why did you stress that so much? Amherst well known for bumping people off?
No, that is where my daughter goes to school.
Oh, well, I mean, that's a little shout out.
Okay, so these were our four major sources, as well as these I've looked at innumerable articles about true crime sleuths, because there's been kind of a long history of sleuthing, but we are right now at
the golden age of internet sleuthing.
At this point, it is. Now, it may even get better. What now is happening more is people are doing like the DNA stuff, and then you have people tracking the family trees. I mean, it's getting like high tech, but also
intrusive and creepy.
I mean, kind of. All right. So as we have learned through earlier episodes, people throughout time have had to interact with true crime. We are looking at true crime and fact as a genre.
Yes.
Which has like sort of a reciprocal evolution. So what true crime evolves along with society's needs.
Yes.
And it's just always a present genre and it serves a purpose in society.
Allegedly.
Okay? Allegedly. That's what we are sort of going forward with. When we talked about that genre, we mentioned that there have been sort of throughout time different ways for society to consume stories about true crime.
Correct.
So...
And they were really lame before.
So. Trial records.
This is a cooler time.
This is much, much more interesting. Today, we obviously can consume true crime in so many different ways, right? So books, television series.
I hear podcasts
are a thing.
Somewhat,
yes. You know, they're making films and things like that. So there are different ways for us to consume our true crime stories. And where before most of us had to sort of satisfy our gumshoe daydreams, but right. just by sitting and reading a book and then just maybe thinking it over yourself, or maybe you had a friend in real life who was interested in true crime as well, and you could talk through those things with them. Well, now you can become an actual online internet sleuth. There are actual groups on Facebook, also obviously on Reddit has a very active true crime sleuthing
enthusiastic
community. So actually now you have real people in everyday life trying to solve crimes, and in some case actually solving crimes, certainly helping to solve crimes,
which just encourages the other ones. So stop solving crimes, you guys. Bringing out all the crazies.
All right. So whether we like it or not, true crime docs and podcasts are playing a role in the criminal justice system.
I remember the Serial podcast did a whole season or two seasons on this one guy and ended up getting him, I think, some kind of appeal or DNA testing or something like that. And I don't remember exactly which podcast that was. But I mean, that's an actual impact on the justice system, right? Where they did this investigative work. Now, these are not what we normally think of as internet sleuths who are really not professional in any way. The Serial podcast, those guys are journalists. It gives them a little bit more restraint and...
Well, and you would imagine...
more measured in their conclusions and not as reckless as just normal citizens are, right? Normal citizens will start investigating something like, hey, I've seen that jacket before. Yeah, look, this guy's wearing that jacket. He's guilty. Let's put his name out there, right? Well, and then everybody who's wearing that jacket is getting their ass kicked.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's actually kind of what happens. And we're going to get there when we start talking about like where it's good and bad.
Yeah.
What we want to kind of question is the role always as helpful, like internet sleuth. If you're a podcaster that kind of tends towards sleuthing, like Paul Holes and Jensen and Holes is one of the there are certain podcasts.
Steve Martin that and Martin Short.
And
Selena Gomez.
That sort of trend towards doing sleuthing or kind of be in entering it. And then there are podcasts that just tell the story.
Tell the story, right.
Okay. So the ones where it's trending towards or authors or journalists even who are writing books or writing or taking part in documentaries where they're uncovering things or looking into it, they definitely have better training and hopefully you would hope that they would be able to, especially if they're investigative journalists, be able to sort of investigate, actually apply some investigative
techniques.
But what I wonder is how helpful are those in actually solving these crimes? Okay. So California authorities arrested a suspect in a 25-year-old missing persons case, thanking the 8-part podcast Your Own Backyard for enabling them to interview new witnesses.
Now, and I think that's really the most useful thing is increasing the awareness of a particular crime so that additional eyewitnesses, can come forward because they may have missed them in the first, go around. That's much more likely to be the positive outcome rather than, I found this footprint here and I matched it up and I've checked his Amazon records and he definitely bought those shoes and now we have our guy. Bringing out more witnesses, which is a tried and true police technique for hundreds of years, right? They'll put up a police sketch. Do you know this dude? Mm-hmm. Go door to door canvassing, looking for eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm. That is just really using crowdsourcing to encourage more witnesses to come forward rather than doing real true crime fighting.
Here's another one. In 2020, a convicted serial killer confessed to another murder on a podcast where the bodies are buried.
Well, that was dumb of him.
A lot of times, if I'm understanding correctly from my research, there are serial killers who actually want the notoriety. Yeah, right? Remember, we talked about BTK.
Sure.
Like, he was getting pissed off because...
Like, if you want to kill people and not get caught, leaving notes is counterindicated,
yes,
right?
That's right.
That's not going to help you stay hidden.
No, right.
They want that excitement and that publicity and the notoriety and the fame and all that comes with it.
So then in 2018, a husband was charged with his wife's murder after the Australian podcast, The Teacher's Pet, brought renewed interest to the case.
So again, publicizing a case. Mm-hmm. Talking about how horrible it was, whatever, that can definitely, especially when you have police departments that are like, look, it's a cold case, we're going to move on to other things, and they kind of put it on the shelf. It can, public interest can refocus that and have them go and take another whack at it. And that can help find a criminal. And I support that kind of true crime podcast 100%, right? Mm-hmm. As long as it doesn't get gross.
Yeah. Right?
So, but I think if it can bring interest to a case... that's great.
So also in 2019, Dutch police launched their very own podcast.
Did they?
Yes, they did, to encourage witnesses to come forward about a 1991 cold case. Several tip-offs contained useful information in that case.
There you go.
So there you are.
Come on our podcast. We promise not to arrest you in any way. If you are the killer, it's okay. We're just being podcasters.
Let's talk about what we've kind of been hinting at, which is how is it well done and how is it not done well?
Done.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, or well done or well-ish.
Yeah. There's always some, negatives.
Okay. So I would say out of all of the documentaries, now I've read reviews and I've heard podcasts about Don't F With Cats, but I can't watch it myself.
No,
you did watch it.
Because there is animal harm.
Okay. This is one of the cases. And this is one of the true crime documentaries here. So it's not, it's about the case.
Yes.
And remember this, because this is talking now about the focus.
Why are you pointing at me? I feel
because
very guilty.
I feel like I'm just coming up with an epiphany. This is like a right now epiphany.
Say it before you forget it.
I better. Okay. Remember we talked about it changing from the criminal to adding in the victim.
Yes.
Now I think the focus is changing yet again, such that you are not only knowing about the criminal because you're hearing the story, you know about the victims because the victims are there, but you're also learning about the people who are solving the crimes, not just detectives now, just like civilians. So now the focus of these documentaries anymore, you can't, it's not really a true crime documentary. It's a true crime sleuth documentary almost. Don't F with Cats. I think
that's right. Yeah. Because that really the whole take with Don't F with Cats was less just this crime happened and here's how we tried to find it. But here's what the internet sleuths are going through. Mm-hmm. Those are the main characters. They're like, here's the sleuthing we did. Here's how we presented our evidence. You know, that didn't work. We almost got that guy killed. You know, oops, sorry. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it really did focus on the sleuths themselves. I mean, that's kind of, I guess, the best of all possible worlds for true crime people because that's how they envision themselves, right?
Correct.
They're putting themselves in their shoes. I'm solving the crime. I've saved the day. You know, I brought this loser to justice. Mm-hmm. And that's how they see themselves.
Well, let's talk about what that documentary is really about in a little bit more detail. I'm going to read the synopsis of
Please.
It. Okay, so it's in 2010, a viral video called One Boy, Two Kittens was linked on Facebook and posted on YouTube. All right, trigger warning, everyone. Descriptions of cruelty to animals coming. The viral video shows a man playing with two kittens before he puts them in a very tight vacuum seal bag and vacuums the air out, suffocating the kittens. Thompson and Green subsequently started a Facebook group to build evidence and find the perpetrator. The group worked together to examine the details of the video, including the objects in the room, to help solve the mystery. What was the role of the police in this at all? Did they talk to any police, or was it all just the true crime?
Yes. No, they definitely did. So what they, I mean, and it's described very accurately. They started looking at this video and saying, okay, what can we see in this video? Here's a poster of whoever the fuck it was, right? Here's the bedspread that he had. Here's the kind of handle on the door that he had. And here is what the outlet, you know, the electrical outlet looks like. And then they just started trying to narrow it down. Now, they believed that they found somebody early on. And they just went wild and publicized it. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out this guy didn't really kill anybody, although he was unbalanced enough that he admitted killing somebody.
Oh, geez.
And then ended up taking his own life.
Oh, so, God. So that was the bad thing about
That's the bad thing about it. But so they were in this big Facebook group, but then they realized at a certain point, hey, this Facebook group is full of very irresponsible people and they're not all super sharp. So they kind of picked their all-star team and went into a private group to talk about it. So they, and the two of the people who were interviewed for the show, a dude and a lady. So they were really kind of the intellectual engine for this investigation, and they ended up tracking shit down, and they were very methodical and way dedicated. Like this was consumed them.
And they would then pass that information along to the police, I would presume.
At a certain point, they were like, okay, we have some information and, you know, we figured out where this killing took place. Mm-hmm. We found this guy who is mentioned in a billion other videos and they have similar verbiage, etc. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this one guy, he was real good. They found a photo of the guy that they think killed the animals. It was a selfie on a different site because at the same time this guy was killing people, he's also trying to self-promote himself as this, you know, super hot model.
Oh, right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Bon vivant.
Yeah.
So they saw that they found him taking a selfie and they like identified a gas station in the selfie.
Holy cow.
And then they found out where those gas stations are located. Mm-hmm. And then he just went to Google Street View and started looking at all the gas stations of that brand in that area and trying to find that same angle.
Wow.
And they found it and then they, you know, kind of reverse engineered it and found the apartment that he was in.
My God.
So I mean, I'm like, that's pretty good, right?
Right.
I mean, maybe this guy missed his calling.
He clearly did.
Yeah, he looked like he was probably, a bookstore clerk or something. Maybe. But anyway, so they found the apartment and they gave that information to the police. Now, there was definitely some resistance on the part of the police when they notified him early on about this video before they had like good information. They were just like, okay, well, whatever, it's just cats. Who cares? Mm-hmm. But the overall message of this series is that's rule zero of the internet is mm-hmm. don't fuck with cats. Because if you do, they're going to find you and they're going to come for you. Right. You can do almost anything else. You can run over an old lady with your car. Right. You can throw your, you can throw a rock through somebody's window. But if you fuck with animals, they're going to track you down and find you. So they, they found the room that he was in.
Right.
And then they finally got a search warrant and they went and they stormed this room. He had been gone since then, but now they had somebody to look for. Mm-hmm. And they started this manhunt. And that's really, honestly, because of
the online sleuths.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Another good one, another one where things went kind of well-ish. It has kind of a sad ending, but it kind of goes well, is I'll Be Gone in the Dark, but about the Golden State Killer.
But yeah, but it's not, it didn't have a sad ending because the killer sprang up and killed a bunch of people.
No, in fact, he, right at the, now I'm talking about the documentary here, not the book.
Oh. Okay.
And then the documentary is really more about the writing of the book and sort of a look at Michelle McNamara, who, so this is fully focused on
the investigator.
The investigator who was just a civilian. She was just an online. She became interested in this case. So, it's about both, but the focus is really on Michelle and her writing the book and her life and how she sort of goes back into Michelle's history. It goes back at the same time into the killer's sort of history.
So how is that sad?
Michelle McNamara died before the book was able to be completed.
Yeah. And they tracked her being sick?
No, she wasn't sick. Oh. She died of complications from a drug.
Oh, drug overdose. That's
but right. It wasn't, it seems to have been accidental. I don't know that it was, I don't think that they've ruled.
That's
it.
How it's listed is accidental drug accidental. Overdose.
So it is. It's really focused on her. You get to the point where she gets super obsessed with it. It is all consuming to her.
Oh, and I think that's like the Achilles heel of true crime investigators is their single-mindedness mm-hmm. can turn up results just because they're so dogged and they have way more free time than I guess homicide police do.
Well, less cases, right?
Sure, if you focus, you just have on the one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you want to impress me, solve four or five murders at once.
Right.
But that's also obviously that can be a huge negative, mm-hmm. right? They tend to believe everything they come up with. And they tend to just act a little recklessly because they have so much confidence in what they've discovered. And plus, that's probably not a great way to spend all of your life is obsessing with one murder case.
Correct.
I mean, some people think it is, but
portion of your life, but then that case ends presumably, and then you continue on and maybe do some other sleuthing then.
I mean, maybe.
Pick a case at a time and dig into it.
We accidentally accused the wrong guy there and a peasant mob lynched him. That was a mistake, but I think we've really learned a lesson here, Tim. I'm looking at you. We've learned a lesson here, and I think next time we're going to be a little bit more measured.
It's not wrong, though. All right, so the good things about this, her story as an internet sleuth, I think is her single-mindedness. I think that it really gave her something that she was interested in.
Definitely gives you a purpose, right?
I think that it brought her some notoriety, and it was well-deserved. She's a good writer.
Yeah.
She was extremely meticulous with her notes and sort of going through things. One of the things that Michelle had that I think that other true crime sleuths, amateur sleuths, maybe don't have or lack. Look, a murder like this where it's unsolved and it's a cold case is like a big puzzle.
Yeah.
And all the pieces are everywhere.
So she had an excellent whiteboard.
No, So it's like a big puzzle and there are pieces missing, right? Even sure. For the people who know probably the most about it, which are the police, presumably, pieces are still obviously missing for them or it would be solved. Then it filters down to another layer removed from it. They don't have access to all of the files and everything like that.
And that's a point I'm going to bring up later, but go ahead.
So Michelle gets a ton of access to the actual files. The point there is that Michelle, because she was well-respected in the community, because she did, she was taken very seriously kind of journalistically, but she saw more of the puzzle than most internet sleuths do, right? Okay, so that's a good thing about this. That's something that lends credence to this. She was very focused on the now he's called the Golden State Killer because she coined that. That's right. her. That's like a big contribution to it.
Right.
But previously to that, he was Eurons, which is the East Area Rapist and the original.
Doesn't really sing, does it?
Night Stalker. Yeah. He was two.
Yeah, it doesn't really sing.
So that's what this story is about. And then, like I said, you know, she dies at the end. But at the end of the documentary, Patton, who saw to it that her book was finished and published. Yeah. He was out on a book tour promoting it when they found out that the guy who was arrested for it, his name was Joseph James D'Angelo, he was popped because of that DNA process.
Wow.
People were encouraged to submit DNA.
Yeah.
And then tests were run. And
you find a link and you work your way backwards and find
ancestry,
the dude.
You know, trees were, they worked with genealogists then to trace back and found him. Found out who he was.
Fuck that guy.
So that's a good thing. The bad thing, again, she became so single-minded on it that I think it really overtook her life. It wasn't just a value add anymore. It became her just total reason for being.
Yeah.
And then that puts a lot of stress on her. And you're reading. I mean, I remember when I watched this documentary. It was actually a little while ago. And I can remember watching it. And I got very creeped out because when they did describe the crimes, they are very frightening crimes. Yeah. And I thought to myself, this was just a guy who's like, he wasn't killing people he knew. He was creeping around through canals. Yeah,
just
and
doing random.
And going into random people's homes, you know? And I'm like, geez, that's terrifying because that could be you.
Yeah.
And so then I'm like, but maybe they left their doors open.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we can victim blame them just a
maybe,
touch.
Maybe, because I wouldn't do that.
Maybe they should have learned some karate.
My point there, though, is that reading and constantly being enmeshed in all of that heavy stuff.
Yeah. It's not great for the spirit.
And scary stuff. It's just got to be really tough.
That's
right?
Why we had to ban you from listening to true crime podcasts. You were going to sleep because you kept having fucked up dreams.
I know I did. And now I don't have time to listen to anybody else's podcast. I'm really behind on my podcasts. I don't have time. So those were pretty good. Those were internet sleuths who do a pretty good job of it.
Yes.
Okay. Now we're going to talk about two that one, I just personally, I know that a lot of people are really into it. I just personally find it to be a little bit
porny.
Well, no. Well, it's his name is James Renner, and he's the author of True Crime Addict, How I Lost Myself in the Mysterious Disappearance of Maura Murray.
Okay.
And he's there to talk again. He's there to talk about the case, but talking about the case is also telling his story.
It's really his journey.
It is his journey, and he talks about the case, and now he's dedicated a large chunk of his life to dealing with that case. But what my problem is while he's an engaging writer, he is fun to read.
Yeah.
He draws you in, and it's almost like a Sam Spade novel or something.
There you
it's
go.
It's like crime noir almost. It is. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. She had gams for days.
Yeah, like or James Ellroy or something, you know? And so he's this reporter who was fired and he was looking for something to do. And previously he had been extremely fascinated with a missing girl case.
All right.
Amy Mahalovich disappeared when he was a young kid her same age, and he became fascinated with her. In fact, he said, I fell in love with her.
Right. That's super healthy.
Okay. So he was fascinated with that case. He's a kind of a specialist on that case, and he's very interesting talking to the guys on True Crime Garage about the Amy Mahalovich case.
Yeah.
That is a really eye-opening listen. Because he gets a little bit not metaphysical, but like kind of woo. You'd hate it. It was he's kind of I manifested him to walk in front of my car. Like,
all right.
So in this, he's really telling his story in this journey, and he talks about how he scored the same level of psychopathy as Ted Bundy.
The investigator?
Yes.
Oh.
James Renner, the author.
That's reassuring.
I know. So he's setting himself up as a character. He's sort of letting you in to know about who he is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very compelling writing. All of that is great. He does a good job of telling the story. He uncovers all sorts of information and he talks about, you know, he brings up some good and interesting angles. But he goes completely awry because as with many of these true crime sleuths, as you mentioned, they get something into their head that they want to believe and then they filter everything.
I think that's the biggest error amateur sleuths make is they're really invested in finding the answer and they're not willing to risk a pet theory and go look for evidence contrary to their theory. Because that's really how you do things. If you have a theory and you have some evidence for it, you test it by looking for reasons not to believe in it, right? Right. That is rigorous scientific investigation.
Correct.
And that's what professionals more often do. Not always, but more often do. Is they're like, okay, we have this information. How could it be wrong?
Right.
You know, what are the weaknesses in our theory? And amateur sleuths, even good ones like this guy, you fall in love with your own theory, and then you're only looking for confirmation.
Okay, so in the case of James Renner, he's working alone. But one of the other things that tends to happen is if you're working with others, maybe in a small internet group, you start to build like a filter bubble around you.
For sure.
Because you are having confirmation bias at that point. And then what ends up happening is that you are really shutting yourself off from everybody else.
You've got an echo chamber and you've got
everybody kind of patting you on the back and agreeing right. with you.
Yes. And I think also they tend to like the more
outlandish ones.
Yeah.
They like the really conspiracy ones.
Yeah, like a snazzy, salacious theory.
Okay, so now James is working by himself, but he's still kind of down that path. He's down a path of like there's a very simple explanation, which would be applying Occam's razor.
It's basically all things being equal, go with the theory that has the fewest amount of added elements.
Yeah, like the simplest explanation is the best explanation,
as long as it fits the data.
Right. Yes. So instead, in the case of Maura Murray, she drives into a snowbank, wrecks her car. She's there one moment, she's gone the next. Someone says to her, can I call the police for you? And she says, no, I've called AAA, which he knew wasn't true because there's no cell service where she was in the mountains. And so he went back to his house, called the police. Within 7 minutes, the police were there. She was gone. Yeah. What they ended up finding was that she had been probably drinking, and driving. And then there was some wine spilled in the car. A box of wine had broken and all the rest in the accident. Okay. So here she is potentially inebriated, thinking, well, maybe the police will come. Well, what's the easiest explanation is that she walked into the woods
and perished due to the... Passed out and then died.
Has not yet been found. There's the other, you know, then there are other really outlandish ones, like, you know, well, not necessarily outlandish, but maybe she was abducted. Maybe someone, it was just a happenstance. It was the right, wrong place, the right time, you know, like that kind of thing.
So if you're looking, if you want to apply Occam's razor in that circumstance, here's how it should be done. First of all, does the theory she wandered off the road and probably passed out and died, does it account for all of the evidence, right? Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence there, like a second set of tracks or, you know, a weapon or something that would contradict that? Well, it doesn't seem to be in this case. So proposing a theory that someone else is involved is not at this point justified by any evidence other than, you know, incredulity is not evidence. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I can't believe she just wandered off the road and, you know, fell into a snowbank and died. Well, people do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But their incredulity for them counts as evidence against a particular theory. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, that couldn't possibly be true. I think maybe somebody took her. Well, okay, you can think that, but it's not really a legitimate theory at this point because you have no evidence to base it on. It's just pure conjecture.
But James Renner takes it quite a few steps further. He takes certain things happening or not happening, as it were. So her parents, her family, her father and her family declined to speak to him. He said, in my entire life, I've never known any family who doesn't want the publicity around talking
maybe they
to
were
them.
Just didn't, maybe they got main character energy from you.
Yeah.
Like you think you're... I mean, he seems pretty impressed with himself.
Right.
And maybe they got that energy from you.
Right.
Like, they're making it about you and not so much about their daughter.
Could be. And so they refused to speak. So then he thought maybe the father had some kind of role in it. Not necessarily that he did anything. But Renner's ultimate theory was in that book is that she was driving in tandem with another car and that she crashed her car, hopped into the other car to start a new life. And she's now either in Canada or Florida because there have been sightings in both places. And then Renner has a webpage up. And at some point he claims that someone who claimed to be her contacted him.
Of course.
You know, yeah, I mean, there's all these things. And so it gets really, really wild with the theories.
Yeah.
And ultimately, so he says, so either she went off and started a new life or maybe someone killed her.
Right. But there's no actual evidence
evidence for either of those.
And the more unusual and fantastic your theory, the more evidence you need to justify it.
Exactly. So that's a case where there was definitely a confirmation bias at a certain point. He had it in his head what must have happened.
Yeah.
And then he looked for ways for that to prove that. And he's still doing that. And now, as a matter of fact, I just received an article today in a little true crime group that I belong to. Someone sent it along and said that there's an attorney somewhere, I guess in New Hampshire probably, who has agreed to take on Maura Murray's case if she is still alive. For, you know, like sort of the speculation is that she disappeared herself, ran away because she wanted to not have to deal with some legal things that were brewing. Well, not necessarily the case. All right. Now, then there's another case of a program where I think it's true crime sleuths gone bad, which was the vanishing at the Cecil Hotel.
So the Cecil Hotel is a hotel literally on Skid Row. Like, that is legit the name of the street or the area that it's in.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Legitimately on Skid Row, which maybe should be a red flag for a hotel. Like, reviews, like, okay, one star also on Skid Row. Okay. But apparently a lot of people have died in and around this hotel because it's a hotel on Skid Row. There's drug use and crime and all kinds of stuff. Of course people died in that hotel. But
Ramirez, the Night Stalker, also
chilled there for a while
in the hotel.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it gave it a little bit of notoriety. Also, not a great advertisement for staying there, people.
No.
Like, Google some reviews. Like, the water was brown and the guy down the hall was killed. Like, maybe that's a good review to pay attention to.
All right. Well, one of the things, though, that, I mean, I don't want to dive down too deeply into the minutiae of the case, but one of the things that I thought was interesting is that the Cecil Hotel was the Cecil Hotel, but for foreign travelers who might have been looking for a place to stay, they had a different name for it.
Yeah, it was Stay on Main.
And so that
Research skills are unparalleled.
Right, which presented itself as
it was supposedly an upscale hotel, but it was also, it shared infrastructure with a crack house.
Kind of, basically. Right, yeah, like a rent by the hour kind of place.
Yeah, no, I was going to say the biggest problem, though, right from the get-go, is they have no idea what the real name of this hotel is.
True.
If you look at the building, it'll say CH, right, as a logo. But then they give the hotel the name Hotel Cecil. And like, all right, I mean, I can live with that. It's just initials. But then you go to the other wall of the building and it says Cecil Hotel. So what in the fuck is the name of that hotel? How do they get mail?
I mean,
what in the hell is going on with this place?
I don't know. I'm telling you, it's a strange hotel, Mark.
Yeah, it really is.
All right. So briefly, the case that this is about is Elisa Lam, who was a Canadian young woman, like 21 years old.
Yeah.
And she...
she came to L.A., I guess, for tourist reasons, right? But like for a long period, long stay, right? She wasn't just coming for a week.
Right. It was going to be... she was going to a couple of places in California.
Yeah. She stayed at the Hotel Cecil Hotel and acted very strangely.
She did. She's somebody who struggled from depression.
Right.
Manic depression. And she actually spent a lot of time writing blogs on Tumblr.
Yeah.
That's when Tumblr was still a thing.
Yeah, and she had a fairly large social media footprint and followers who, you know, I mean, she shared her struggles and insights and hopes and dreams and all that stuff on her Tumblr, and then at some point disappeared. Days and days and days and days. Couldn't find her. Searched the hotel. She was gone. Nobody saw her leave.
They're watching hours of video trying to see what, but then they find her at one point.
They found a security video inside of an elevator where she was acting very strangely.
Pressing all the buttons and like kept looking out the elevator. And
as
then
if
like
there was somebody following her.
There or whatever. The doors never closed. And eventually she gets out of the elevator and she turns to the left and she's gone. That's where she disappears.
And that's the last time we saw her.
And that's the last time they have any record of her existing. So then the police release that video.
Yes.
On out to the public and correct. Say, can you help? Do you know who this girl is? The video goes viral. In the meantime, they discover Elisa in a water tank on the roof of the hotel.
Right. Horrific.
Naked and in the water tank, and she's drowned.
Yes. Well,
they presume.
Yes.
Then they go and they do an autopsy, and the autopsy is kind of inconclusive.
Because there's probably a lot of deterioration because she was in a water tank for a month or whatever it was.
So they do the autopsy. The autopsy comes back in a way that isn't necessarily satisfying. And that's kind of the gist of it. But it's been ruled an accident.
Yes.
Her death has been ruled an accident.
But the online community sleuths went bonkers.
Before the final
thing
came out. And this is where you get into some really crazy conspiracies. So they get a hold of this video and they look at it. Somehow they're combining the video and the history of the hotel.
Of course, yeah. So they're like, okay, so this is a creepy hotel. Therefore, you know, let's be on the lookout, folks, for supernatural killers. You know,
supernatural things could have happened to her.
Yeah, and by the way, if you're bringing that energy to an investigation, please stop. It's not supernatural. But yeah, so they're combing through the entire internets looking for, you know, reasons why this girl might have vanished. And they find a guy that they think looks sketchy.
Because he's a death metal guy.
Yeah, he's a death metal. Oh, yeah, he's a musician. But he posts videos and, you know, it's death metal. So what does he talk about? Death, mostly.
And dark things. And they find a video where they think it shows him reenacting what must have been the case with Elisa Lam.
Right.
And they persecute this guy.
Oh, yeah. They put him on blast.
The online community. These are not the police. The online community. And they persecute this guy to the point where he considers self-harm because it's just become so overwhelming.
Right. And he's not sure, like, should I stand up for myself or is that just asking for trouble? And, you know, he's like, look, I know I paint my face like a demon and stuff, but I'm just a dude.
I'm just a guy. Right. And he talks about it later and he says, you know, in the end, it was a terrible experience and I don't ever want to have to go through like anything like that.
Of course not.
Again. Yeah. I mean, who would want to?
And now one of the things they found is that he had shot some footage in the Cecil Hotel. Like he had stayed there at one point. What they didn't know, because they're just randos on the internet, is that he was in the Cecil Hotel a year before Elisa Lam, and he was out of the country. He was in Mexico with an alibi the week of her killing.
Correct.
But see, that's the thing is with these amateur sleuths, is they sometimes forget that they do not have access to all the information. Mm-hmm. Like you pointed out with the Golden State Killer, that she was given access to more information. And that's critical because police will deliberately withhold information from the public in order to help them identify the criminal correctly. So if you give out all the information about a crime and say, go ahead, internet people, well, guess what? Then you're going to get people who fake confess to it, and they're going to know all the information, so of course they get it right. Mm-hmm. Well, they withhold information like that to be able to tell if someone's doing a copycat confession. They're like, oh, yeah, and then you left him in the trunk of that car, and they're like, yes, I did. And there's no trunk of the car.
Right.
It didn't happen. So that's what people forget, and they don't understand how police investigations work, so everything looks suspicious to them. Mm-hmm. For example, they were suspicious that they blurred the timestamp at the bottom.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they had a reason for that, right? Maybe they had an investigative reason for that because they didn't want people to say, oh, yeah, I saw her at 11:01, which is 1 minute before she entered that elevator. No, they want to say, hey, I saw her. And they're like, what time? Right? To see if they're giving true information.
Correct.
And they kept saying, well, the film is skipping. Well, look, the security camera was apparently a potato.
Yeah.
Right? Because it was not high resolution 4K. And they're like, you know, she pushed this button and the door wouldn't close. Well, what they didn't know was there's a button on that door that says hold door.
Right.
And it makes the door stay open for 2 minutes.
That's
and
right.
She was hammering that button.
So there's a lot they don't know. But then what happened that also great conspiracy theory, but totally wrong and outlandish, was that she was a government plant sent there to infect the homeless on Skid Row with tuberculosis.
Right. So it turns out that, and unfortunately for people who are doing internet conspiracies and investigations, there are no coincidences.
No.
Right. They assume all coincidences are just not coincidences. They're real evidence of conspiracy or, you know, false information, whatever it is. They assume that every, you know, little glitch is the police misleading them or this big, big coincidence. So it turns out that there is a lab test for tuberculosis. Isn't that what it is?
Mm-hmm. It's a
lab
for test. Tuberculosis.
That was this girl, this poor girl's name backwards.
Lamalisa.
It was Lamalisa, which, by the way, stands for actual stuff, right? It stands for really long scientific alphabet words. And her name was Elisa Lam. And what they don't stop to think of is, let's say it was a government conspiracy, right?
Right.
Why let's say what it was. Why would you tip people off by going, well, what should we call our tuberculosis spreader? I don't know. Just what's the name of that test we do? Lamalisa? Okay, Elisa Lam. That's her name. Because I can't think of any girl names.
I mean, it's...
But no, they're like, oh, let's give them a fighting chance to discover this.
Let's put a little breadcrumb
down. That's the crazy thing about a lot of conspiracy theories is they're like, well, but why, you know, but it has 17 letters. And it's like, now, why would they do that? Nobody does conspiracies like that. Like it's like a Batman villain, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, okay, we're just going to do it as a puzzle that might end up fucking us over at the end of the show, right? No, they don't do things like that. Mm-mm. Of course, that is a wild coincidence, mm-hmm. but also nothing to do with the case.
It's a wild coincidence. Yeah. And in the end, she accidentally died. This program, though, was enlightening to me because it really hammers home the true crime porn aspect of it.
Oh, absolutely.
Because a lot of those people now, and it's a weird combination between internet and true crime porn.
Yeah.
And the thirst for clicks for your own platform.
So I don't know what the name is of the social media person who like did the tour, like the video tours of the Hotel Cecil Hotel. Mm-hmm. But I was so skeeved out by her whole vibe, mm-hmm. her whole demeanor, because it was really like, you know, like it was a haunted house excursion.
Really, right. It was not She's taken like, seriously.
We're walking by the elevator. The door won't close. What should we do? Oh, no. You know, like, it's like, fuck you.
She was a lot. And the other thing that was evident from the Cecil Hotel was how very close to the victims sometimes people can get.
Yeah.
The one guy said, oh, someone went to her grave and put his hand on her grave for me.
And filmed it for me.
So I'm like, oh, bro, wow. You know, I mean, he just felt like that was someone he knew. He was very invested. Now, I think part of that has to do with the fact that she did share so much about herself personally
online.
So they have then gone back and fetishized.
Like, oh, now I know her.
Everything that she's written.
Because I read her poems.
These are these deep, dark, I mean, you really want to know someone. She's laying it all out.
Oh, yeah. She's,
I mean,
she's
deep,
not hiding
dark
anything.
Thoughts. All right. Well, let's talk about now, in the introduction, I talked about postmodern thought and postmodernity, and I'm going to talk about postmodernity and the rejection of experts. This takes us all the way back.
To war on science.
So while you might have thought that this was a crisis of meaning thing because we're talking about true crime
you might
and people
have.
Like true crime, no, indeed it is, a war on science because it's a rejection of experts.
Yes.
I think that true crime sleuthing, to me, I always get the idea that people think, well, the police can't do it. The police, and especially since the police have been so called into question.
Yeah. They're like, okay, these guys are Mayberry. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring my superior intellect.
It's like Barney Fife.
It is like Barney Fife up in here.
All right. So Jessica Maddox is a professor of digital media studies. I'm going to read a couple of quotes from her at length. So
lay them out for us. Can you do it in an accent?
No.
All right.
She says, so often when we speak of the current backlash against experts in many Western countries, we rightly focus on things like environmental science, climate change, medical experts, and the COVID-19 pandemic. While internet scholars, myself included, have long eschewed the idea that online practice should ever be thought of in terms of pathology, I'd like to talk about one specific ism here, solipsism.
Yeah.
Solipsism essentially means it's impossible to know something outside of yourself. So if you haven't experienced it or if you haven't read it, you're less likely to believe it. The internet isn't about obsessive self-love. Instead, in the fragmented information environment and filter bubbles we put ourselves into, solipsism becomes the cultural ethos. If it happens outside my echo chamber, I don't buy it.
Now, I have had discussions with people who choose not to take the vaccine or are skeptical about, you know, COVID. And they do have this idea that if I haven't seen it, it can't be real. Like, I don't know anybody who died from COVID. I'm like, well, that's okay. But a million people did. But it was always very, like, I'm just using common sense and what I see. Well, that's not a very good way to do epidemiology, right?
Right.
No, they do. They have much more sophisticated tools than that. And I think also the internet gives them a false sense of, an inflated sense of confidence in their abilities, because they have all this information at their fingertips. You don't have to worry about not knowing, you know, the capital of Maine or the population or, you know, how, what the speed limit is on that road. You can find any of that stuff out. Mm-hmm. And it gives them an inflated sense of their ability to then be an expert or be better than the experts.
Correct. And then, of course, mix in confirmation bias and just sort of a rejection of science generally. And you get people that are like flat earthers.
Yeah.
You know, so in these little filter bubbles, conspiracy theories can really ignite and take hold, and you're in that bubble. And it's really hard then if you come into contact with people outside that bubble that feels like a threat to your...
Of course it is. They're challenging your worldview.
So it's... I know that solipsism is about an individual.
I guess group solipsy.
It's just... I mean, I suppose it's just because when you're in a filter bubble, you filter out all of the other things that could get into you.
Right.
You only let in what aligns with what you believe.
It was very interesting at the end of the Hotel Cecil, Cecil Hotel documentary, where they're interviewing a lot of the most dedicated investigators. Mm-hmm. And when they're told, okay, it was just an accident, they're like, no, that can't be. I don't want it to be, you know, that. Mm-hmm. They kept saying what they wanted it to be. And then to their credit, a lot of them did say, oh, okay, I guess that's really what it is. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, look, I didn't want it to be, you know, just a random accident. I mm-hmm. wanted to be able to find the answer, mm-hmm. to find somebody to bring to justice for this. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, I guess I got to accept it, which I think is pretty unusual. I think most people in that mindset don't end up accepting it. There's like, you know,
they,
what?
Maybe not. They just can't believe it. It can't. Yeah. It's got to be a cover up.
And
but
that's,
you know,
that's using incredulity as evidence, which it isn't.
Going back to this idea of true crime as genre and genre as this particular genre as something that will help you heal the rupture. In this case, that person is saying, ew, it's just an accident. Because yeah. remember, because
that can happen to anybody.
Because that can happen to anybody. So again, I'm starting to really lean into that concept of true crime as genre meant to heal the rupture in the fabric of society that is caused by some sort
away.
Of to explain why these things happen.
Yeah.
And well, how it's probably not going to be you. I mean, it's probably not going to be you.
Right.
That's probably not going to happen to most people.
Well, and I mean, I think there's a good historical basis for saying when humans want an explanation, and if they don't have one that's obvious, they'll make one up. And previously it was in the form of myths and legends. Now it's conspiracy theories, right? Mm-hmm. And there's always an explanation for why, you know, you can't find all the evidence for this. You're like, oh yeah, so we took your theory and we investigated it. We couldn't find any evidence for it. And you're like, that's exactly what happens when there's a conspiracy, right?
Right?
All the evidence disappears.
Exactly.
So we're forced to now operate on, I don't know, intuition? Who knows? but it's just really, I think... I mean, I think it's a reasonable idea to say that these people don't value, not that they don't believe other minds exist, but they don't value the content of other minds if it doesn't agree with what their preconceived notions are.
What's curious to me as I'm thinking through this is that the sooner a case is solved, obviously, whether it's solved and they find the killer or it's solved and it's something like this, like it's just a terrible accident or a suicide or something like that, you know, where there's a solution. The sooner that happens, obviously the less likely there are to be outlandish theories about what could possibly have happened.
They get a little crazy after a while.
They get a little crazy after a while. And now I'm thinking about Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
Because at no time in the Jack the Ripper investigation does anybody who was actually investigating it suggest that
he was a member of the royal family. Right.
But as time goes on, more, you know,
they're
people.
Like, there must have been a cover up. Who could have gotten.
Who could have done this?
Who had that kind of power?
That's right.
Well, clearly the royal family.
Right, exactly.
Therefore, they're guilty. Let's shout it from the rooftops.
I mean, and they did draw some interesting connections between an artist and the women, some of the victims in the...
But if it's too interesting, it's probably fake. But it's
right,
probably false.
Right. Yeah. Like it's so, but that happens with others too, right? The longer that the case goes, the more you're going to try. And that's interesting to me because, again, confirming this idea that true crime and crime stories are a way for us to try and heal the fabric. People are just keep coming with these theories because for whatever reason, that wound is still open.
Yeah. And they want to...
They want to fill it in. Yeah. Even though we are, you know, hundreds of years removed from Jack the Ripper, that guy doesn't exist anymore.
No.
You know,
he's definitely dead.
He's dead.
We can say that with no doubt, unless he was like,
Connor McCloud.
Yeah, exactly. Unless he's Highlander. I do think that one of the reasons for the war against experts. Mm-hmm. Is that people see themselves as experts.
Do you think it's because of the internet?
Because you have so much information available and you're like, I could do this. How hard could it be? Right? I'm smart. I'm not dumb. Like you said, I'm smart. Mm-hmm. Like, so you did a poll on your Twitter.
I did do a poll on Twitter.
Are you above average intelligence, or below average intelligence? Right. Now, it wasn't a huge scientifically accurate poll, but how many people said I'm below average intelligence?
0%.
That's right. Now, can that possibly be the case?
Definitely cannot be the case.
Now, I know you have very smart friends in general.
I do.
So it's a little bit of a self-selecting sample, but you don't, I think I pointed this out on a previous podcast. Nobody ever says, they'll be happy to say, you know, I'm overweight, I'm short, you know, I'm poor, but nobody really likes to say I'm dumb.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not smart. Everybody thinks that they're not only not dumb, but they're really smart.
Right.
Because in your own head, you don't know what you don't know, right?
Right.
It seems like you're very smart. And now you have the internet. You have all kinds of information. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand that information is not intelligence.
The Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah,
they think they're smarter than they are. And that's fair enough. I think that most people who are actually really smart might... kind of say, well, you know, I do okay. You like, because you know, not Mark. Here comes a joke.
What I do is I have my own self-opinion so high, like so outrageously high, that even if I'm wrong, I'm still pretty high. So, that's how I do it.
Okay.
Like, I think I may be... in the top 3 or 4 all time, right? And then if I find out later, no, I'm really only in the top 3 or 4%, I'm like, well, that's still pretty good. I mean, that's not bad.
All right, but I do think that, and you're not wrong, I think they have more understanding or access than they do, but if they actually had all of the files... that would make a big difference because all of the evidence that the police maybe have.
But, I mean, even if they did have all the evidence, they might not have the skills to do anything with it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what am I going to do with all this information? Well, you have to actually have developed those skills, those analytical skills and those investigative techniques to know how to make that information tell you the story.
Right.
Now, there are cases where they can, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, in the Don't F with Cats, they had at least a couple of people who were pretty good at computerized investigation. Now, they still almost got somebody killed, or they did get somebody killed.
Right.
So that's a problem. So they're not going to get, you know, the Fenton Hardy commemorative detective award. But they,
the, you know, Joe and Frank.
The Joe and Frank. I got my Joey. But
no, I agree with you. But so they do. Some of them are very good and some of them aren't as good. They're definitely polarizing. I have spent some time on some Facebook groups that are dedicated to specific crimes that I have a big interest in, particularly the Delphi murders. I belong to one of the Facebook groups. That's a strange world.
So do I, I think you had me join that group. I have no idea what the fuck they're talking about.
The true crime community is a very strange community. Not strange in a bad way, just different. It's just, it's intense. It's very intense. So here's another, you know, online community where I'm surrounded with intensity. But there are people that will come in as trolls again to these pages, and they'll act like they're somebody else, but then everybody.
Right. Hi guys, I'm Bridge Guy.
Yeah, you know, whatever. No, but there's a pretty good chance that he does frequent.
Oh, those, sure. Why wouldn't
certainly
you?
Certainly, he's probably been in those, right? Yeah. Like, there's a strong suspicion that he might have. Well, anybody, any criminal now.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? If you want to really fetishize what you've done,
yeah. And plus, you want to know what people know.
Yeah,
I mean, cops aren't going to tell you,
right?
So you go into those things.
So, but the other thing that happens is that there are some true crime sleuths who maybe have like vlogs and things that they do where they're talking about unsolved mysteries and things like that. And they will infiltrate those groups, and they will come into those groups, and they will be
just fishing for info.
Well, but or polarizing figures come in there and say, "You don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, right.
I'm right about this. Yeah. You're wrong.
I have my own site, so you guys are total peons."
Right, right, right. So that is something that happens too. So there's a whole online. There's the online element to this makes it conspiracy minded and tends towards that way. But it also makes it can be very contentious because it brings sometimes people who have different opinions about a subject that they're all passionate about, and they just clash.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the recipe of internet group, all focused on a single topic, mm-hmm. high emotional stakes. First of all groups eventually develop a culture, mm-hmm. right? Some kind of set of socially, some mutually accepted rules. Or
a social contract, as it were.
Yeah, exactly that. We should do a podcast about
that. We should.
But they always develop a culture. So now when new people come in, right, they're like, you don't know, sit down, stay in your lane. We've already talked about, AW and CL and SV or
Yeah, because everybody goes by initials because this is smart. They don't do side-by-sides because that can lead to trouble for people. So they discourage side-by-side comparisons between photos of people from Facebook and the wanted poster for whichever criminal they're after.
Right.
Everybody has initials. They don't name names.
Right. But they also start to develop jargon. Mm-hmm. And really, the purpose of jargon ostensibly is to communicate better within the group. But what it really is exclusionary. You're now marking this is our group, and people who don't get this inside joke or don't know this term aren't part of the group.
Well, right. And then look at Don't F with Cats. When they were on a big group, and then they said, come on, we're going to get into
these
this
guys
little.
Are idiots. All right, we already got one guy killed. We got to kind of, let's trim the team down a little bit.
Right, right.
To like the size of, maybe a basketball team.
Right. We'll still swim in that pool and see what
somebody comes up with.
But they might stupidly say something, but we
have backstage
we
passes.
We are the ones. We are the leading voices in this true crimedom.
Yeah. And people do have, it's an ego investment there as well.
Right.
They want to be the one, right? They want to be the bitch in charge.
Exactly.
We've seen that in many internet groups.
Well, people look for
status within that group. Well, and that's, the magic of the internet, right? You can be who you want to be, and who these guys want to be is something that increases their status within their selected group. So I want to be a genius sleuth. I want to be a tragic figure.
Right.
Right. I want to be, a leader of men. Whatever it is, that's the identity that they take on. And unfortunately, that also skews any information or thought processes that they bring to the problem. Mm-hmm. Because they're at the same time they're trying to solve this crime, they're also, and maybe primarily, trying to increase their status within a group.
Exactly. So it's an interesting community. I've had a lot of fun doing the research on it. This whole true crime arc has been a lot of fun for me because I've been able to really dig in. And
by the way, we don't think that all true crime fans are wingnuts.
No, not
of
all.
Of course not.
No. It's always there are extremes, right?
Exactly
there are always extremes. And when you get to the extremes is when you sort of run into some brilliance.
But then also dumbassery.
Some dumbassery. And sometimes it's both. Like, it's the same person. Sometimes there's somebody with, a real spark of brilliance doesn't mean you're not a wacko.
Right. Yeah, you can be wacko and smart.
Exactly. So, so we are going to have one last true crime-ish episode to follow up this one. We are going to be inviting back two special guests.
Wow.
They are going to speak to us this time about inventing Anna.
Oh, yes. You're going to have a big part to play there.
They are not poor.
They're not basic.
They're not basic, Mark.
Well, I'm looking forward to that because that is actually a good series, and yeah. your Anna voice is amazing.
Stop being so basic, Mark. Okay, so we're going to have Kelly and Joanne back on,
right.
And they're going to talk. They talked with us about the Tinder Swindler 4 or 5 episodes ago, right. Maybe 6. I don't know. It's all blurring together. And now they are going to come back and talk with us about Anna Delvey, and right. We are going to dig into the question, who's worse?
Right. Who was one treated differently because of gender?
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever.
What's the scoop? What do we feel about these two cases? And that's going to be having them back on for good and biased discussion, Mark.
I like that. That's my favorite kind. I like it.
All right. So we have some social media. I am at Serious Produce on Twitter. Mark is at Mark Eats Peach on Twitter. We have a podcast Twitter, which is Extemporaneous2. We have a Facebook group, which is Gen Extemporaneous. And we have an Instagram at Gen Extemporaneous. All right. Well, I think that's it, Mark.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.
Bye.
Wow.
And they would just be like rambling going through and like, she bought a 7-Up. Did we find 7-Up in her body in the autopsy? Is there anything there about the Uncola? No? If that's not, then maybe this is a false 7-Up. Maybe somebody else bought the 7-Up. Let's now go look and see everybody who bought a 7-Up in the city that day.